It's kind of hard for people to really understand genuine community these days, because often when people even come together, they come together to get something, take something out. Or they come together to experience something for themselves rather than a sharing experience, where there is a giving and there is a receiving and there is kind of an aggregate appreciation of what is being shared. So many times, it doesn't matter what religion or what group, what is based on political, economic, sociological, cultural, religious considerations. There's more of a tendency that people form community without community. It's like pseudo-community. Because where there's a real sense of community, we'll see a tremendous amount of progress based on cultivating the human spirit, and where there begins to be much more of a capturing of the magic of spirituality. But there cannot be community, first, without genuine communication. As these people talk at each other, as these people do not really communicate based on really knowing each other, because we're much more than just the body, the gender, the race, the environment, the socialization. But we are that internal potency and aspect, which is the soul or the atma. And the soul, it has attributes and characteristics, and it has tremendous adventures and experiences. So usually our communication is not so much based on who each person really is. So it starts us off in a tremendous shortcoming. So there must be genuine communication where people understand each other and where they're ready to put things on the table to explain with honesty. And then always the higher good comes from that, when there's proper understanding of the actual individuals and what the higher goals are. Second, there cannot be a genuine sense of community without genuine cooperation. And that's also difficult. Even in big businesses, people come in to train employers simply how to cooperate. Facilitators involve themselves in all areas of life, just trying to help people to cooperate in a world where cooperation is not so important, because people are mainly concerned about their self-interest. They don't realize how their self-interest is really so much based on if they can really be selfless. It's almost ironic. People are thinking by being selfish that they will be able to attain great happiness, but actually the opposite is there. Because love is never just based on just one trying to get something. There's so much in that take society. But it's so much on the experience of sharing, especially the experience of giving. And there also cannot be healthy communication without a genuine sense of communion. Where there are distinct things that people are sharing together, and things that have great value that they're sharing and experiencing. It's like if you're a wonderful person, you're a kind person, you found something wonderful, you want to share it, it increases also your appreciation of it as you share it, particularly with those who are whom you're beloved. So one interesting thing that has happened is in most parts of the world, we have more and more fragmentation happening, less and less community, because people are not seeing the value of coming together and sharing and growing and reinforcing each other in healthy ways. But so many relationships are based on how people engage in some mutual sense gratification, where they pretend somehow to be actually caring and supportive. So sometimes in ancient cultures, we often explain certain high philosophical and theological points through stories. So I want to mainly share a few stories with you after I tell you a little bit something about some of my own involvement. One of my chief involvements around the world is in trying to stimulate a community. First it happens with trying to stimulate leaders. I meet many diplomats, presidents of countries, celebrities and whatnot. Important because what leaders do, they set the role models and the patterns for others. But when leaders' consciousness is not elevated, they stagnate, they manipulate, they exploit others. So while they must be grasped what work always done, the masters are most important, but the leaders often have the power, the money, the finances, the influence. And especially because their role models often look, their role that they play is looked up to others and they try to emulate such. So as I write books and I interact in such ways, I'm trying to influence consciousness. But more significantly, is that I involve myself in trying to stimulate people to be able to bring out their higher, where they can activate spiritual life and deal with the day-to-day problems that we're confronting with. And one of the most significant day-to-day problems that we're confronting with is how to be spiritual, how to access anti-material considerations when we're totally surrounded with materialism. Or how to use materialism that it acts as an aid to stimulating the spiritual. And so I've involved myself for many years in particularly looking at ways and trying to be involved in creating self-sufficient communities. I had worked for many years in Africa, about 16 years. I'm also an African chief, a psychotherapist, a person who is involved constantly in trying to resolve conflicts, crises, whether it's on a personal level, between individuals, corporational level, or national level. But what is significant is creating environments that naturally enhance the devotion, that enhance the love, that enhance the ability to be able to understand more about the past, to deal more with grabbing benefit of the present, and to be able to capture and understand more about the future. To be able to connect with that beyond just the material realm, the material senses. To be able to have a greater understanding of life after death, life on other planets. To be able to be more blessed with higher entities and higher beings that are so active in various environments, but can be contacted based on our own quality. The more that we have deep spiritual quality, the more we will literally summon the association of entities who also have similar. Those that we see as well as those that we do not see. Basically, as we associate, more is going on that we do not see than what we physically see, feel, touch, taste, etc. So there are, of course, many ways of how to capitalize more of what we tangibly experience, as well as those things that are part of the reality that we're not so normally or usually conscious of. And so, one thing that is so significant is simplicity. See, many of the complexities of modern-day society literally weaken the human spirit, stagnate our ability to connect and commune with the soul, or to allow the soul's essence to come out, and to commune with those transcendental and anti-material things. So I have created in many communities, especially in the African countries, upon the leaders that I interact with, is that whatever we eat, that we grow, whatever we wear, that we manufacture, or things we need, we manufacture, such a way that people begin to become more controllers of their destiny. So in several parts of the African countries, all of the spiritual paraphernalia that we basically use, we manufacture. Some things we export to other countries. We have hundreds and hundreds of acres of land and embark upon agricultural development. And the idea is how one can be less a slave of science, of technology, that is not necessarily neutral. In America, I have a community in Pennsylvania, about 500 acres of land. We build our own houses, we grow our own food, we're gradually becoming more and more involved in alternative medicine. We have practitioners in every aspect of holistic health care, constant workshops, seminars, retreats. We are accessing more and more alternative sources of energy with the idea of becoming more materially self-sufficient so one can become more spiritually active. Otherwise, we have spiritual interests, but at the end of the day, we still find ourselves controlled by materialism. So I want to share one or two stories to help to focus us on somewhat about community, about sacred wisdom, about universalities, and ways how we can try to be more careful about propaganda and be able to access more wisdom and more truth. Because one of the things that constantly stagnates most of human civilization is the propaganda. People are so much thinking that life is simply about eating, sleeping, mating, and defending and perfecting that only. Or people are so much thinking, if they are not selfish, then they're going to miss out. Or they're so much thinking that if they really give their hearts, then they're simply going to be abused. They're simply going to be exploited. It's not to say that abuse and exploitation isn't rampant, but a lot of it's rampant because people are afraid of genuine communication, genuine communion, genuine cooperation, and they're thinking that the opposite of that is going to produce auspiciousness. So when so many people play into that, it becomes hard for one to step out of that when the basic cultures are cultures that are causing people to follow the illusion. In the Vedic scripture, there's a story, some corollaries of the Vedic scriptures, about a great king who had an advisor named Bhagavan Das. See, in ancient cultures, a leader would not just be a dictator or an autocrat, nor would the leader lead from behind or lead from the side, but would lead from the front, but with certain type of guidance to check one's decisions, or to monitor. And so one would have the priestly class that would be nonpartisan, and they would give blessings, they would monitor what the leader would do, and they would give guidance based on the spiritual paradigm, so that whatever policies were there would bring about the highest good for the greatest number of people, and would guide them toward evolving more effectively. So in this one case, this king, he had several advisors. But he had one special advisor named Bhagavan Das. Kings in ancient times would often be in their positions for life unless they became crazy in some way. But their advisors were often elected or appointed at different times, so they would change. So many times the advisors would be very, very intent about how to capitalize in their positions and to do things for their self-interest, knowing that they may one day not have that position. Or they would position themselves to have it as long as they could, so you find in present-day political arena. So the problem was that Bhagavan Das was a very deep philosophical person. He was a very genuine human and spiritual being. He was a very selfless leader. But he was surrounded with other advisors who were just tyrants and were right out gross exploiters. So because Bhagavan Das was genuine, his presence and his advice was a disturbance to the others because they couldn't do their cheating, their conniving, their conspiracies so easily. Since the king had so much trust in him, the king would take his word over theirs. Bhagavan wanted to create a greater sense of community amongst the advisors to be able to help the larger community itself. But the advisors were more interested in their own sovereignty. So they devised a scheme. They conspired to get rid of Bhagavandas. So they told the guards, never allow him to enter again into this palace. So weeks and weeks went on, and the king noticed that Bhagavan Das was not officiating in the court. And he inquired, what has happened to my chief advisor, Bhagavan? So the ministers, the other ministers, they gave the report, oh, didn't you hear? Bhagavan Das has passed. So the king was very, very taken back that here one of his best advisors had left him. But he felt also very sad that someone had given him such good service and left. He did not have a chance to pay condolences, to offer any assistance to the family. So first, he called the doctor to find out if this was true. And the doctor also was a cheater, was part of the conspiracy. And the doctor told him, oh yes, he distinctly had a heart attack. I ministered to care. So later he called the Minister of Finance and he gave him some money. He asked him to take some jewels, some money, and to send it to Bhagavan Das's family. And the financial minister was also a deviant. And he simply took the money and they divided it amongst themselves. So such collective cheating, producing such powerful illusions. So one day, the king was walking about in his kingdom, in procession. And Bhagavan Das had an idea that now he would try to approach the king since the guards would not stop him, or doctors stopping him at the palace. So the ministers had a feeling that Bhagavan Das may try this. So they had already told the guards, make sure that he doesn't come anywhere near the king. So Bhagavan Das tried it a few times and he couldn't. But then, as he saw the direction the king was going in, he ran ahead and he climbed up in a very tall tree. And he started gesturing and waving and calling. So as the king got closer, the guards noticed that Bhagavan Das was trying to catch the king's attention. And they were bewildered. Because if they ran up the tree to try to grab him down, the king would notice. They let him stay there, the king was still going to notice. So, as the king approached closer, he started seeing Bhagavan Das gesturing and calling. And then the king came over to the tree, was getting ready to make contact with Bhagavan Das. But then the ministers, in their massive general conspiratorial move, they request, oh no, Your Excellency, that is not Bhagavan Das. That is Bhagavan Das's ghost. And so as they all shared with that mentality, then they came back to work. The report of such story is sometimes people so expertly, so collectively, so meticulously engaged in propagating the illusion and the ambiguity, that people begin to play into it and to accept it. So especially in these days, when there's so much communication, misinformation, so much massive centralization, it is important for people to go beyond just the normal patterns. The normal patterns are full of so much inauspicious karma. And to take close investigation, whether it's a political, social, religious, philosophical situation, once you look close to try to dive for the essence. Another short story I'll share with you. Similar, again emphasizing royalty, sacred knowledge, community, advisors, leadership. So there was this washerman, in India we call it dhobi, who would just wash people's clothes. He had this donkey. It was very dear to him. The donkey was so dear, it was more dear to him than anything else in his life. Every day he was just so much meditating on the donkey, caring for the donkey, reflecting on the donkey, eager to go back to be with the donkey. But one day, he comes to die. And Adobe, this man, was totally destroyed. Just as when someone we love, when they depart from us, even though we may understand about the science of reincarnation and transmigration, still even then sometimes the separation is like overwhelming. So, often in Vedic culture, when someone leaves the body, certain rituals is performed, taking engaging in oblation, shaving your head, etc. And many days of different types of yoga rituals. So, he immediately shaved his head, took bath, and then as he started moving about, the king's priest noticed the rituals that he was doing, and he had a shaven head. And he inquired from him, why have you shaven your head? And the washerman said, oh, didn't you hear that Gandhara, his animal was named Gandhara. Didn't you hear that Gandhara has died? Sunanda Gandhara, actually. Gandhara is really a name for an angelic class of beings. This is in all traditions you hear about angels and archangels. And in Vedic tradition we have Apsaras and Gandharas. These are like special angelic hosts that have beautiful voices. And they give tremendous benediction as they travel in and out different planetary systems. So they're giving his donkey this amazing name, Gandhara. Because if the donkey makes his funny sounds, he saw his sweet music. So, the priest, when he heard that Gandhara, he didn't know who Gandhara was, but because he didn't want to seem ignorant, that he immediately went and shaved his head and started engaging in certain oblations, the bath and the sacred river. So, later, the minister of the king noticed that the dogi and the chief priest had shaven their heads, and they were going on this, doing certain sacred ceremonies. So he inquired, who is it? Why are you engaging these rituals at this time? And they also explained to him, oh, the priest explained to the minister, we have been informed that Gandhara, Sunanda Gandhara, has died. Great entity has descended from this kingdom. And so, by the minister being close to the king, and the king seeing that his king priest, minister, and even the dobi, the washerman, they all had shaven their head, signifying that some serious situation has come about. So the king inquired and informed him, the minister informed that he was also honoring the fact that a great, great personality has passed. So the king wanted to be a proper leader, being in tune and community with his constituents, he didn't want to shave his head and start taking extra bath in the sacred river and doing certain puja. So the queen, she's looking around, seeing everybody with shaven heads and all engaged in certain ritualistic activities. So she asks her dear husband, what is going on? And the husband said, well, someone very great in our kingdom has passed. Someone named Gandhara, Sunanda Gandhara. So the queen, and sometimes women are more practical about certain things, and the queen says, well, who is this Sunanda Gandhara? Who is he? What does he do? What is he about? So the king says, well, let me go ask him. My minister, he's the one who told me. And the king asked the minister, and the minister was very much intense because he realized the king was always to be informed of things fully, and it was his duty. So he said, just wait, let me go find out from the priest. He's the one who told me. Then he approached the chief priest, and as everyone is doing these spiritual rituals, the priest is supposed to be the caretaker. And the priest says, well, the dobi is the one who first informed me. So then, the priest went the devotees. We need to know a little bit about Gangadhar. Who actually is he? And the watchman Dobi, he became very grave as he heard the name of his most dear beloved, Sunanda Gandhava. And he started talking about, oh, how wonderful the association he used to have, and how merciful, how much love he had for Sunanda Gandhava, how much love Sunanda Gandhava had for him. And now Sunanda Gandhava has his disease. But who is he? And the Dobi just died with tears in his eyes. Oh, he is my ass. My donkey. So, sometimes people get caught up in patterns that others are doing without considering the value or the significance. So therefore, so many people do not access the deep spirituality, or no spirituality at all, or when they involve themselves in spiritual things, it is all just something sectarian or just on the surface, and they miss the chance for real growth and real deep experience. I want to share this last story with you. I spent, as I said, many years in Africa. There's this one African tribe in East Africa that displays some interesting things about community, sacred wisdom, and attuning to addressing more the human spirit. I read a lot of books, and some of the books I write is on leadership, some is on psychic phenomena, the spiritual aspect of it. Some of the books are on meditations and prayers. Some of the books are on relationship, etc. I've written 5 books, and my most recent book will be coming out in 2 weeks. So sometimes we also have stories and events of how certain teachings or philosophies assist in practical considerations. So this East African tribe, when a woman wants to bring forth a child, in my most recent book deals with sexuality from a physical, metaphysical, psychological, and spiritual perspective, wants to bring forth a child, she goes into deep meditation, begins to engage in chanting, toning, and meditating to try to capture the mantra, the sound that's connected with the soul. Everything is full of conscience and full of vibration. And mantra is so important. Ma means mind, tra means the devil. Mantra basically is sounds that we chant, especially very powerful sounds, especially names of God. They have the amazing ability of accessing higher consciousness or freeing one from stagnation. Just to give you an example real quick. If you look at the various religious traditions, we find so much significance about the chanting of the names of God. It's like in the Bible, in Romans, it explains that whoever calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved. In 113 Psalms, it says, from the rising of the sun to the setting, constantly, the one should invoke and call on the name of God. In the Quran, the Quran 1780, it says, call upon the Lord, Rahman, Rahim, the most merciful, they're all the same. We call upon him. In Quran 780, it says, the most beautiful names belong to God, so call upon him by them. In the teachings of Buddhism, the Vow of Amida Buddha, Vow 18, it says, whoever calls on my name shall attain me in paradise. In the Mormon teachings, Book of Mormon, page 282, verse 7, it says, call on the name of the Lord in the morning, in the afternoon, in the evening. Call upon him by them. And the Zoroastrian teaching says something very similar about calling on the Lord at different times of the day. Some of the metaphysical schools, mystery schools, like Ekankar, Rosicrucian, and the teaching of Ekankar, your right book of your right to know, it says that the most powerful vibration is the name of God. And by accessing that vibration, it frees the mind from anxiety, from stagnation, gloom, and various types of frustration. In the Bhagavad Gita, in the 10th chapter, Krishna says, of sacrifices, I am the chanting of the holy names of the Lord. We're going on, but we don't want to do it too much, taking too much time. But the emphasis is that the chanting of God's name is so important, or the chanting of mantra. So in this particular culture. That when the lady was ready to bring forth child, she understood the importance of calling on God, and especially trying to connect with the mantra that's associated with the soul. But she would leave the village and would engage in that reflection until she could capture the particular mantra associated with the soul. Once she would capture that mantra, and she would go back to the community, and she would share that mantra with the husband. See, the consciousness of, I was discussing last night, I do this in some of my books also, explaining how the consciousness of man and the woman, when they come together for sex life, influences the kind of soul that they bring into the environment. So when people are engaged in sex life without accountability, when they're engaged in sex with somebody they do not love, then they're not going to access a strong aggregate of love to bring in a loving being. When they're accessing, when they're engaged in the union, without letting the natural thing happen from that, then they will not be able to access the deep kind of consciousness that draws the entity that wants to associate with that level of collective consciousness. So, in ancient civilizations, before people engaged in sex life, they would cleanse themselves physically and mentally. They would engage in chanting and praying and meditating. They would access more spiritual culture so that they would be able to invoke a spiritual essence. Now, one of the biggest problems in civilization is people are not engaged in scientific spiritual procreation, and so they're constantly bringing into the environment more and more lower evolved entities. No wonder the kids are so violent, have attention deficits. No wonder they're killing their own parents. No wonder in many cases they don't have much interest in higher things. But where there are people who are involving themselves in higher perceptions and involvement, then they will have a greater tendency of being able to invoke more evolved beings. So, in this civilization, in this culture, after the woman has captured the mantra, then she would repeat that mantra to the husband. So now the husband also knows that mantra. Then, when they would come together for sex life, they would both involve themselves in invoking that mantra. As they are both together trying to honor and to bring forth that life presence with love, with devotion, and with intent. Once the woman becomes pregnant, when she's pregnant, then later she teaches the same mantra to the midwife. And so the midwife begins to chant and to reflect and to call, vibrating that mantra. Until time for the pregnancy, then after the pregnancy has been carried its full course, then the midwife, as well as the wife, as well as the husband, they are chanting the mantra as they are receiving the soul into the community. After the child is born, members of the community are also informed about the mantra associated with that particular person who has come into the community to be a part of the association of the collective experiences. Every major rites of passage, that we say some scholars, every major significant event for that particular child, first taking of food, first day cutting hair for the man, first day going to school, a birthday, anniversary, wedding, and every major event, the community collectively shares the mantra as a way of blessing, as a way of associating and giving their love and attention and support to that particular being who they've all consciously accepted into the community. And at the time of death, the community comes together. And what do? They come together, accessing that same mantra associated with that soul as they invite that living entity to go on to its next existence, as they have tried to associate and share to give that soul the highest service and love that they can, and then they lovingly embodying the soul to make its transition. So here we see first its conclusion, see the importance of the individual being welcomed, being received by love and devotion, and how it can keep us more in tune to the ancient and the sacred things to allow us to go beyond the propaganda, as the propaganda is there by so much, you see, modernity, industrialization, propaganda is there by so much leadership that's fallen, as in the stories I told about Bhagavan Das and Sunanda Gandharva. So often people accept something, and because many people are accepting it, they consider that this is the thing to do, it becomes a normative pattern, and then many people lead a life of degradation, a life of mundaneness, where they miss the great adventure, the great excitement of spirituality. So we all want to, more and more in our lives, to look for the essence. We want more and more in our lives to have greater appreciation of the quality of life. And we do that especially by honoring life in all ways. And we do that by this powerful sharing that goes as we try to remind each other more about our higher goals, about entering back, becoming more in tune with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and engaging in various types of rituals and practices that takes us away from the stagnation and brings us into this sublime level of consciousness where whatever happens becomes an adventure and experience and is honored by a collective community involvement so that we can take the greatest value, the greatest benefit of this life, as human life has never just been for eating to be made and defending, but it's for pursuing self-realization, it's for returning back to our natural state where we are no longer just restricted by just the senses at their present state of evolution, but where we're able to experience the higher aspects of our being, where we're able to literally come to what's called Vasudeva platform, seeing God face to face, communing with the spiritual kingdom, of being able to invoke divine intervention where we make a change for ourselves and with the planet at a very critical time. So let me stop there and see if there's any questions that you may have. And by your questions, then I will tune into various areas of spiritual phenomena based on the kind of questions that you offer.
What do you think is the appropriate relation to sexuality if there isn't an intention to produce a child?
Well, it's like sometime back I was asked to give a message to the nation on Valentine's Day by the Washington, editor of the Washington Post. Washington Times, Washington Post is one of the two most important newspapers in the world. And so, as all this stuff about President Clinton started accelerating, I write books on leadership there at universities, and I address some of these issues of promiscuity at the principal synagogues. And in the interview, the religious editor asked kind of a question about sexuality in terms of abortion, etc., homosexuality. My comment to him was very simple. When we do the most natural things in the most natural way, we get the most auspicious result. The most natural aspect of sexuality is that people come together to share their essence to be able to produce something from that essence. The most natural aspect of sex life is that we honor the life that can come from two living entities coming together to share their life to produce a life that represents the result of their physical and psychological and spiritual essence. When people come together and they perform the most natural thing in the most unnatural way to get an auspicious thing, it's like you're inviting someone into your home, and as you catch their attention and they're coming forth to come into the house, and then you stop them from coming in. What to say if you invite them and then you destroy them or you take their life? It would be considered actually quite offensive. The first thing is, if that's your mentality, then why invite someone if you're just inviting them to abuse them, to misuse them, you're inviting them to deny them. So the most natural result is from sex life, there is procreation with intent, with love, with higher consciousness, and we get the greatest results. Any other questions?
What about the
Yes, that's again where community is important. See, keep in mind, the husband calls the mantra, sorry, the wife calls the mantra, the husband calls the midwife, and the community. Now, of course, they were informed, and so they were encouraged, in such a way. But also, we can help someone without them being conscious that we are actively involved. As a matter of fact, we do it every day. Every day, we are hurting or helping. Because anytime people are associating, they are sharing consciousness with each other. As we move about in society, we are products of heredity and environment. We are products of our physical body, our subtle body, most important. Our subtle body is an aggregate of experiences in so many different lifetimes. So when people interact, they're actually interacting with many people at once. This is why sometimes relationships are very difficult. When you're relating to somebody, we're relating to many, many different personalities in that same entity in one sense. But they're a product of so many karmic patterns. So we can, by what we have within us, then we share that, or that spills over in the environment. Sometimes things directly that we say or do, but most important is what we are. And we can see that. It's like in this room here. There's some very loving people. Some haven't even said anything, but it's just what you are carrying. Because of what you're carrying, then you infuse the atmosphere in various ways because we're carrying a particular force field with us at any given time. We've all seen that. Sometimes we meet someone and we don't know that person. We don't have any interaction, but we just feel very disturbed. We feel very uncomfortable. Sometimes we meet someone else, we don't necessarily know the person, but we feel very comfortable, very good about just being in that person's association. Because actually we are communed, in that there is a sharing of the person's consciousness, the present consciousness, and a sharing of some pattern from the previous life is being experienced in that interaction, in that dynamic. So the greatest way we can help someone is that we develop more and more spiritual purity and potency within ourselves. Then as we interact, we share that, or we connect that with another person. We can also, in a more tangible way, we can engage, of course, with certain rituals or associate with the person in ways of that nature. The most important is what is internally carried.
You spoke recently to American Medical Association about reading in terms of the life force or consciousness. Sometimes it's described that the life energy is kind of sapped by certain associations.
Yes, as I travel around the world, sometimes every 2 weeks I go to a different country or so.
Related to health.
Yes. And recently I was guest speaker at the yearly convention of the National American Medical Association, which is an association of doctors. They meet for a week or so. Basically allopathic health. But many of them are turning to naturopathic activities, alternative health care, because it makes money. And also many of them are so sick themselves. It's like when I was speaking at the conference, I started off by emphasizing physician heal thyself. Because doctors, as a populace, have some tremendous problems. They have some of the shortest lifespans of any profession. It's very common for doctors to die in their 40s. They have some of the greatest rates of addiction and also divorce. And the highest rate of all, in any profession, divorce. So I was emphasizing first there's a need to heal yourself. A need to recognize that there are toxic institutions, toxic leaders, the planet is toxic, and there are toxic practices that many of you are involved in. And there's a need to be more holistic and look more at healing the individual in a more substantive way. I think your question was asking in terms of about the nature of the soul. The life energy. So some of the allopathic doctors are just beginning to see that as they treat their patients, sometimes are not able to help them. Some of those same patients go to alternative practitioners and they distinctly see that the disease is cured. Many times it has to do with some practitioners who consciously or unconsciously are able to alter the prana. It's like some people are healers. Some people are just born with the ability of such potency within them. So just by touching someone or being around someone, they're able to alter the vibrations, the prana energy within someone's body. Different techniques, acupuncture, acupressure, a lot of these, even massage, along with many things that it does, it has ways to affect the airs in the body. One way of understanding mental illness is just so many imbalances in the airs in the body. One of the differences between a more evolved soul and a less evolved soul also has a lot to do with the prana, the vibrations that are in the physical and the subtle body. So there are certain techniques that affect that. And there are sometimes even ways to be able to measure. The allopathic practitioner wants to measure everything in a behavioristic and inductionistic way. So some of them are beginning to move in that direction. The fact that I was invited, and I was invited by the family practice section, which is a pretty orthodox section. And so, because I, in my writings and in my presentations, I do kind of an eclectic thing, looking at the physical, the metaphysical, and the spiritual. But because I approached it in that way, what I said was very relevant, and I had a standing ovation afterwards. Wow. I sold many, many books. Many of them bought every single one of my books, all five of my books. Mainly because they hit it home that many of them in that audience were undergoing drug addiction, been divorced two or three times, and were quite unhealthy, or realize that constantly around them they're seeing their colleagues die or want to leave the profession. So there's a real crisis in allopathic medicine at this time. I think some of you are involved in alternative medicine and alternative health care. It's going to be even more important in the future. As we begin to see certain aspects of modern day civilization crumble, it's going to force us in many ways to become more natural. It's going to force us to be able to access more ancient wisdom, sacred teaching. It's going to force us to take less shelter of commodities and begin to access more sense of community. Now people are replacing community, with commodities. People are replacing the sacred with just convenience. So many sacred teachings now, we hear them described as mythology. Greek mythology, Indian mythology, African mythology, Hawaiian mythology. Now, because people are not able to understand the magic, not able to access and dive deep into the adventure, then when they hear sometimes about so many wonderful paranormal and very unorthodox things, they categorize it as just mythological, because it's outside of their realm of understanding and appreciation. But there's so many wonderful things. What is really mythological is that how people so much play in to just mundaneness, do not try to, explore beyond that. But sacred teachings are very much needed. Why? Because the great, deeper aspects of spirituality have an amazing, exhilarating, and amazing unifying aspect. So much of modern things deal with the moment, deal with the body only, deal with basic sense gratification, and those are not deep enough to unify humankind. And that's why we find more and more fragmentation based on tribalism, based on racism, based on nationalism, based on genderism, and based on religious fanaticism. You see that one of the greatest ills that's affecting the planet is fragmentation, because people are doing so many things superficially. Unless they go deep, they will not touch upon certain universalities that will allow there to be significant unity with diversity. Any other questions?
Yeah, most of us are on some sort of spiritual path or do some sort of spiritual practice, but how would you recommend breaking addictive patterns? And by that, I don't only mean alcohol and drugs, but like
eating
word patterns, emotional patterns that are self-destructive or harmful to others. How would you recommend, like, you know, recognizing and rooting it out? I mean, are there some quick and easy ways? Or, you know?
I was just talking about this a few days ago at the Hare Krishna Temple on Honolulu. You know, we're all addicted to something or many things, no matter what the addiction is. And the biggest addiction, we're addicted to these physical bodies. Because in most cases, our level of awareness is not always so high. So because we're not doing things to purify the senses, we get so much addicted to the illusion, we're addicted to certain, you know, temporary distinctions. And now people are getting more addicted to eating disorders and to all kind of external sources. And it is unfortunate to be a slave or to be limited by any kind of something that imposes on you and causes one to be so much captured by that, when our natural existence is to be intoxicated from higher consciousness. So when we keep taking shelter of artificial things, it can minimize our ability to have the natural conscious-raising experiences, where we're experiencing a level of intoxication that's far beyond any kind of intoxication we've ever had contact with in this particular body. It's like sometimes we find it in yogis and rishis. There's this time in India that somebody heard of the Kumbh Mela, different periods of the Kumbh Mela. There are times when you don't see these yogis until 12 years. They all come down and they associate and they move about. Now some of them, they live in caves. Some of them do not eat, do not even drink anything. They live only off fun. Only off life force, only off air, and the energy that's connected with that. Now, it is the most natural thing for people, as we're discussing, to be in relationships and to be engaged in community. So what the hell is going on? Somebody's living in a cave by themselves, not eating, having no relationship. And we call that spiritual. Well, what happens in many cases is that yogi, when he goes back to his cave, he leaves his physical body and he goes. He goes out of that physical body and has all kinds of experiences in the subtle level of the astral body, because it is by nature that everyone needs relationship, routine, experiences. Now, such persons who have a basic understanding, control, and higher realization, and are not stagnated by the physical body, then for them, there are so many, many opportunities or times when they are just absorbed in such ecstasy and bond that's far beyond any intoxication. See, it is natural at the same time to want an opposite state of awareness. It is natural to want to hide, because our present situation is unnatural that to consider that there's nothing more than in this day-to-day existence. That is an unnatural state, because inwardly we all know there's something greater. We're constantly looking for that greater and greater ecstasy. So, in looking for that, sometimes we get captured by the mature ecstasy. Does the drug get called ecstasy also? So we take shelter of such, because there's a genuine knowingness and a genuine desire for the altered state. But if we keep taking shelter of the drug, we actually take away from our ability to have a genuine. Some people say, but hold on a minute, but the experience of the drug is a real experience, and I get that. It's like a blank check, talking about what's possible. Let me hang on to what I get. Well, it's just like sometimes when we're sick, we have to, you know, we kind of go through a transitional period where we may, you know, sleep a little more, watch our diet a little closer, take some sort of treatment. Well, that's an integral period to help us to establish ourselves again in the natural state. So when we refrain from the external intoxication, involve ourselves in more regimented life and ritual. Yes, at first it's a kind of an imposition, it's like a drag, you know? But it's really to allow us to go through the transitional period where we are now naturally healthy, where we have the ongoing ecstasy as an ongoing part of our consciousness. I give that example of yogi, he's showing how there are people who sometimes have transcended the material, and they're experiencing a high level of out-of-state consciousness, awareness, involvement, and intoxication, when there appear even to be the almost the opposite. Just like, you know, I write about celibacy. I'm a celibate monk. I've been celibate for about 30 years, not about 50 years old. And so in some of my books, I talk about sexuality from many ways, explaining about homosexuality from a metaphysical and spiritual perspective, explaining more about parenting and more about sex life based on inviting higher beings. And also I often speak to nuns and priests and monks and yogis who are trying to do a sex interview, etc. And one of the things that we also share, that one cannot be a genuine celibate just by repression. Because union is always there. Everything is in union. Whether it's electrons and protons and atoms, everything is relating, compelling, coming together, forming this union. You don't avoid that. But it's a matter of the quality of the union. So, or a matter of, you say in Sanskrit, pranam just done about to say, replacing a lower thing with a higher thing. So when there is higher connection or higher displace of energy or connection of energy, then one may not necessarily need or find themselves having to relate on another particular level. So real celibates are always about giving deep love. And as they're having deep loving connections, then there's not so much a need for physicality. See, one of the problems we find today, or there's so much increased promiscuity, or there's so much infidelity. See, I was just looking at a study here the other day, studying about how people are lying more these days. But they explained that the most lies are concerning, you know, infidelity. So many people are not being genuine in a relationship. Or divorce is on the rise, everything. And one of the reasons is that people are so much prone looking for another partner, are so much prone for going other places for sex life, are so much prone for having so much sex life, because they do not have deep quality sexual experiences. If you're eating and you're fed nicely, you don't have to go to another restaurant. You're satisfied because you had a healthy meal. But because people are so unsatisfied and they have to go so many places, so sex with somebody else's wife one day, sex with a man one day, sex with a child one day, another day sex with an animal. And this isn't happening. Because people are knowing that union is necessary, is needful, but at the same time they're not having deep experiences, and because of that, so many things are on the surface and they feel so incomplete. But in ancient times, there also was a science, such a science as we say of sex life. And so people had such deep love of each other that it didn't just come down to genitality or physicality. Sex was, the physical sex was a part of the love, a part of the culture of sharing, but it wasn't the all in all like it is these days. Because they had such deep love for each other, just by touching their beloved's hand, just by looking at their beloved's eyes, just by walking on the beach, just by walking in the park, just by sharing some food stuff, was union. Because the love was so intense, it was connecting and spilling over. But now people are so much into themselves, and even when they have a partner, it's not really a partner. The partner is just an extension of their own gratifications. As soon as that's not happening, they're ready to divorce and find someone else who's going to enhance their own egocentricity. But when there's this deeper love, then everything becomes like an experience and an explosion. And then one doesn't have to have so much frequent sex, or one doesn't have to go so many places, or one doesn't feel so incomplete because they are so much sharing their own completeness. Like last night I was explaining some of the technologies in my Transforming Lust to Love book. And I mentioned how the tendency is that a woman is looking for a man who's going to make her feel complete. And a man is looking for a woman who's going to make her feel complete. And so they go out looking around or making themselves available, thinking that somebody is going to make the miracle happen for them. But what happens? Two incomplete people who are needy like anything are looking for somebody who's going to make it happen for them, and they come together and they just drop their frustrations and anxieties on each other. And they're disturbed thinking, but I thought you were going to make my life complete. I thought you were that Prince Charming I've been dreaming about. I thought you were the, you know, and it produces great anxiety. But when people become more genuinely loving within themselves, then, one, they don't necessarily have to find a partner, but they do find a partner. They're trying to find someone who they can share their completeness with. So it's not just a relationship where it's just a take thing again, or a so-called partnership and it's not partnership, or so-called community and pseudo-community, but it's genuinely somebody who has become quite whole, materially and spiritually, psychologically, and now they want to share what they have with someone who's also similar in completeness. And those kind of beings come together. As they move about, everything becomes a union. And then when they do decide to have a union, then they bring in very, very powerful beings who want to be a part of that level of collective consciousness. But these days, almost the opposite. People want to have the experience of the physicality without accountability. What kind of soul is going to be so drawn when they're not really that much wanted? Other questions? Yes? That was kind of the essence of the lecture, one thing. I'm glad you brought that up. That's where community becomes important. Mm-hmm. See, we vitalize each other by our associations. Like many of you, or many people who have a higher consciousness, who carry the higher consciousness, have to constantly interact with people of lower consciousness. What is that if you're in the helping professions, where you're constantly trying to give? As you're giving, you're also getting drained. As you're giving, you're getting affected by what other people are carrying. So unless there's proper rejuvenation, after a while you get what's been economics called diminishing returns. You are giving, you're giving, you're giving, you're putting in, but you're gradually getting less and less. One of my books is called Uncovering Spiritual Truths and Psychic Phenomena.
You were just a channeler there,
Mara. Uncovering spiritual truth and psychic, because I guess five things are confusing which one is. Uncovering spiritual truth and psychic phenomena. And in this book, I mainly wrote it for New Age community, but mainly for psychics. People who are involved in helping others based on their own powers and potencies, but who often get contaminated in the process, or who often are not quite so even aware of the polarity of pious beings and pious energy versus impious energies. You know, some people who can heal the sick, people who can read minds, the mental telepathic, they're clairvoyant, they're clairaudient, but they're empowered by sinister forces. And they've gotten that power to do such things as they're in connection with disembodied entities or sinister forces, or they do rituals that actually invoke powers but are degrading in how they access and use those things. One way to obviously tell is that when you find you're around people who have certain powers, certain abilities, but they're not talking about love and devotion, selflessness, but it's all about conquering over, manipulating, getting rid of your enemies, becoming this thing, getting that thing, it can be dangerous. Is it can mean that they, yes, definitely have abilities, but their abilities is not so much based on really cultivating the human spirit. But it's mostly about, because just as we have angels and archangels, Apsaras, Gandharvas, and so many other highly evolved spiritual beings, we also have very powerful evolved negative beings who also engage in all kinds of rituals and engage in all kinds of activities, but mainly for stagnating human civilization. It's like at this time on the planet now, we have amazing influx. See, the Earth planet is like part of the middle planetary system. So, and it's like a special station. See, on some of the higher kingdoms, there's a certain amount of pleasure and satisfaction that some of the beings become complacent. On some of the lower realms, there's so much suffering that it becomes hard to access higher realization because you're basically dealing with basic, you know, issues of survival. But the Earth-like planet is very special. And that's why beings from the lower realms as well as higher are often coming here, because it has this duality. It has this duality of suffering, of happiness and distress. It has this duality of lower and higher. And so it becomes a place where the quality of the environment, if one takes full advantage of it, one can leap by tremendous bounds more than in some other arenas. So this is why you have this kind of war going on at any given time of some entities who are trying to harness the minds of the populace based on a demonic influence as well as those who are doing it through a spiritual influence. I bring that up because many of those people who are caretakers, who are part of this particular level of evolution, they are open somewhere, a little more psychic, either consciously or unconsciously. And so they shine, their subtle body shines, stands out, and it becomes more obvious. Their existence becomes more obvious to those higher evolved beings as well as those who are stagnant. So such people, if they're not constantly protecting themselves and reinforcing themselves, not only will they get drained by lower people who they're dealing with in their day-to-day practice or association, but they will also be attacked and affected by those who notice entities who are trying to evolve who want to stagnate in a different way. So it's very important to engage in kind of a regulated, based on regulated practices, where each day we surcharge ourselves. Through reading sacred scriptures, through hearing sacred music, to engaging in meditation, in chanting, intoning, to engage in eating food that is more invigorating for the mind and consciousness, so that, and engage in associating with people who also have something higher, so that when we are being drained, we can be more stimulated in such ways. It's like a war in one sense. That's why I call my series Spiritual Warrior Series. I have one group of books called Spiritual Warrior Series, emphasizing that when you take the spiritual life, you really need to claim war. You claim war on illusion, on temptation, you claim war on evil, and when you posit yourself in that way, you're also up for being noticed. Based on that, one must have sufficient armor. And the spiritual armor are the spiritual practices that we engage in that gives us sufficient.
I'm going to follow up on the same thing. A lot of it would have to do with the kind of work we do, because some fields allow us to be very spiritual. And I work with the subscriptors to be very spiritual. But if you work in a factory, how much factory you have to be like in the world. In the bhakti process, isn't there a way, almost any career position where you touch your foot with a chant? So there's a lot of the
yes, as long as it's not a distinct sinful work. Any work, you know, it's a distinct sinful. You're working, you know, in a butchery. There's no way you can so much spiritualize that. And your whole life is like taking life and contaminating people with your eating, without eat, you know, so much reaction. But some professions much more accommodate higher consciousness and serving the Lord directly. But some professions, the way that we spiritualize them is what we do with the fruits, what we collect from it. And as we are using some of the fruits in such a way, then some of the negative karma of that particular service or work, one is not bothered by it, but it becomes like that work is a catalyst for maintaining body and soul together. And being able to help to facilitate some type of spiritual type of activity or some type of conscious raising type of thing. And we can all do that in some way. Whether working in a factory or a secretary, working in an office, this thing, that thing. We can see the work as a way to facilitate our what? We want money, we don't have to worry about money. So that we can accomplish certain things, we don't have to be locked in to so much anxiety. We want shelter, good shelter, so we don't have to worry about it. We want good clothes, what else? We don't have to worry about these things. So as we have such things, we don't have to worry about it, we can put more energy into the most essential things. But if we don't have it, then we're trying to be spiritual, and you haven't eaten in 4 days, in 4 weeks. That's not going to be so easy. You're trying to be spiritual, and you have 20 creditors on your back. You're trying to engage in meditation, man. And you're just thinking, who's calling me? Who's going to come and possess this? Isn't that so easy? You possess even the pillow you're sitting on. So these things we want, not to make it the all in all, we want them so that we can then maintain ourselves to do our real work or our higher work. If you want to do that question. Please.
The first is, where does the change come in? And the second is...
Let me take the first question first, and then I'll come to the second.
Okay.
As I mentioned about how different traditions give some emphasis to chanting, especially calling on God's name. Exactly what do we do when we chant? When you're chanting, you're calling someone's name. And as you call that person, you're also inviting them for association. The more distinct and powerful an individual is, the more dominant and powerful a thing is, when you call it, even before the physical association, you're already associating with it. As you call someone, then you are bringing already subtly the association. Physical may or may not necessarily happen, but you already associate. So as you invoke the name of a very powerful person, and you associate even more with the dynamics of that person, or you're a powerful being, even more with the dynamics of that being, with that being consciousness. So therefore we engage in the mantra chanting because it has a cleansing effect. Just as when we take shower, take bath, so we clean the physical body. But then the mantra chanting is cleaning the internal aspect. As we're associating with those higher things, then we're engaged in the cleansing system. And second,
I've seen for years so many people in their spiritual life, and I've seen terrific struggles in trying to figure out the balance between evolutionary material development as an extension of the spiritual growth and renunciation that is actually destructive. The balance. It's just, what's the key? What's the sign? When you draw the line. You have people going from sometimes fasting to extremes, but then by what standard? You know, some people thinking about having meat for extremes. And it's true. They're horrified. What is being
not believe it or not, this is where spiritual mentorship becomes important. Just like in a secular sense, somebody is trying to involve themselves in a legal situation. Somebody is trying to involve themselves in a business deal. At what point is it too risky? At what point is it too excessive? At what point does one need to involve himself more? Basically, in all areas of life, we get facilitated by using our intelligence and being able to take advantage of proper context. A person is not very wise if they try to do everything themselves. A wise person knows when and how to elicit some help. some guidance. Who to connect with, where to get information. Some ways to say. So similar in our spiritual life, in order to avoid many, many difficulties, in order to try to capitalize more, using our time and getting the best out of things, then there's a need to be selective, but to have mentorship. If someone wants to be a good musician, a good artist, a good sportsman, yes, they read, they do this, they do that, but what's really going to help is they associate with someone, become a little more competent in that way. That person can help them from reinventing the wheel, can help them to move through things faster, can warn them in certain things, and guide them in certain ways. Read the Bible. Now, of course, one of the difficulties is finding a good mentor. But one of the difficulties is finding somebody who is a genuine mentor. Because many people hang out a shingle, or many people present themselves as guru, as acharya, as prophet. And they're prophet, guru, acharya for their own ego. Because their real intent is not to really help. Or they want to help, but they do not have so much of the power to be able to make a difference. So just as when you're shopping to buy fruits, to buy vegetables, to buy a car, to buy a house, the person has something in mind that they want, and then they must connect with where that is available, then they must look for quality based on such. So when there is proper spiritual mentorship, then one is guided through things, maybe there's one step first. The need for being a proper student, the need for being a proper teacher. Sometimes you have a good student, but the teacher is just not so evolved. Sometimes you have an evolved teacher, but the student is not so smart. Sometimes you have a good doctor. Doctor gives the prescription, gives the care, but the patient doesn't take it. Sometimes the patient takes and does exactly what the prescription was, but the medicine was not potent. And the doctor was not so sharp. So when there is serious enough student, many people fall because they're just not serious students. They're serious about trying to remove the interferences in their material life. And so many people involve themselves in spiritual paths not because they're genuinely interested in spirituality. They are genuinely interested in trying to remove some of the obstacles that interfere with their sense gratification of their spiritual, of their material life. And so they tune in to the spiritual stuff with the idea that it's going to make a difference. Other times people are tuning to spiritual life because they're still playing the same material game. They're doing their rituals, they're connecting with God, but it's still the material game because their whole mood is, I've done this thing, I've done this, now what are you going to do? So they're thinking, well, I tried this, tried that, it didn't work, so now let me try the God stuff, and maybe God will give me what I want. So it's still all about materialism. So those people really trick or cheat themselves. So their fall or their stagnation is their own exposure of cheating themselves. They're thinking that they can bribe God by some rituals or some external things without giving their heart. So at some point, they get a chance to work deeper on themselves. They're not ready to work deeper on themselves. That's where they fall. Many, many falls in spiritual life is really the person being given a chance to grow. They're being given a test to go to a higher level. But the same test that can help you to pass and to accelerate and get certified can be what can cause you to fail. I mean, many spiritual, that's why I write leadership sector as well as spiritual leaders. I write many things trying to help leaders in spiritual communities not to fall. One of the things that I explain in lectures, I have a ministry, I'm on TV 3 times a week in Washington, Virginia, Maryland, 1 time a week in Detroit, and soon to be 1 time a week in in Philadelphia. And I've done my own TV shows in Africa and Kenya for 6 or 7 years, etc. So in some of these programs, we discuss how to solve material problems with spiritual key solutions. And one of the things we often share is I interface and facilitate sometimes, you know, different conflicts and trying to help leaders, even in other traditions, with their issues. As we share that when a person is a spiritual leader, the more resources they get, the more man or woman power, the more disciples, jealous students, staff members, the more that they are growing in their external kingdom. To that degree, they must grow in their humility. Otherwise, they'll fall or something. Let me explain that. If a leader is have a certain level of consciousness, start to acquire more and more material things, the leader's going to fall. Because as you have more and more distinction, adoration, prophet, facility, you don't also simultaneously become more humble to it, then it becomes electrocuted. Then one begins to think that they're the proprietor, they're the controller, it's happening based on their strength, their God's blessing to humankind. And that just sets them up. There was so much of the pride, egocentricity, it sets them up for the fall. And that's why you'll find more spiritual leaders have a tendency to fall than to remain fixed. You know, you'll be shocked if you can go from big leader to big leader, international big leader, international big gurus, and you'll see most of them are cheaters. Because they're embezzling money and they're engaging in illicit sex with their students, their disciples, and their secretaries. More than not. Because unless one understands the art and the science of how not to do, one will in fact later get caught up in it.